Before we get into today's episode, I want to share a free resource designed for anyone feeling anxious, overwhelmed, or weighed down by life's uncertainties. It's called Peace for Anxious Hearts, a free 10-day text series from Premier Insight. Each day you'll receive a scripture verse, a brief word of encouragement, and a simple prayer to help you turn anxious thoughts towards Christ and rest in God's presence. If you've been struggling to find peace in the middle of a busy, uncertain world, this resource is for you. Sign up for free today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And our conversation today was sparked by really interesting conversations you've been having over the last week or so when you were at an international Christian medical conference in South Korea, I believe. Tell us a little bit about that and what you kind of came away reflecting on after speaking with some fellow doctors from very different parts of the world.
Yes, I've had a fascinating experience just over the last couple of weeks. I was at a global congress of the ICMDA, that's the International Christian Medical and Dental Association. And this is a kind of jamboree which happens about every 4 years. And it's a wonderful meeting of Christian involved in healthcare, medics, nurses, administrators, researchers and so on, from literally around the world. Over 1,000 people there, lots of students, over, I think, 120 countries represented. Mm. And an amazing chance just to get a panoramic view of what's happening to Christians involved in healthcare. And at the conference, you got a complete range of people, some working in highly sophisticated, westernized medicine, through to people working in pioneer missions, sometimes under extremely poor circumstances, people working in public health, in medical research. It was a fascinating and very encouraging, stimulating time to spend time with Christians. A great sense of unity, particularly the worship times together. But I was asked to give a talk about injustice in and the ethical issues raised by injustice globally, inequity in healthcare. So I spent some time talking to Christians working in different countries around the world about the issues of inequity and injustice which they're confronting.
And the thing that you told me that I was kind of surprised, or something I hadn't really heard about, was that actually some of the decisions, the investments, the breakthroughs, the new kind of exciting breakthroughs in medical science that we're seeing here in the West and enjoying some of the fruit of, actually they can have somehow quite negative consequences for healthcare systems in poorer countries. Can you just explain how that can be?
Yeah, well, inevitably, you know, in our globalized world, and everyone has access to the internet, everyone has access to a lot of popular news about advances in healthcare and so on. And there's an enormous prestige with westernized healthcare. Even quite low resource countries often have, you know, centers of excellence, sometimes private hospitals, sometimes a government, you know, centralized teaching hospital. And there's a huge amount of push for the country to be able to say, we have the latest healthcare equipment here in our own country. You know, we are able to match the kind of transplant surgery or the advanced MRI scanning technology which westernized countries have developed. And that means that Western medical devices companies and medical equipment companies have found a market, even in low-resource countries, for some of their most expensive equipment.
I mean, shouldn't we be celebrating the fact that you don't have to be a white, rich Westerner to have access to some of this breakthrough equipment or new drugs and technologies? Isn't it healthier for this stuff to spread around the world from the countries which can afford to do the research into the places where there will still presumably be people ill enough to benefit from it?
Well, obviously, this is where it gets complicated. So, yes, there are clear benefits to be obtained from even some of this very advanced technology. But in countries where healthcare budgets are extremely constrained and limited, and where Western equipment continues to increase in its cost, and particularly currency, you know, you require dollars or hard currency to pay for all this equipment, the implications for local healthcare can be very significant. So governments may spend a very significant proportion of their budget on a sort of prestigious equipment and hospital. The net effect of that means that there's very much less left for other things, just like paying decent wages for their healthcare workers. So the wages which doctors and healthcare workers receive in many of these countries are scandalously low. And this is one of the reasons why, which then contributes to the fact of the brain drain. So people say, well, I can't possibly support myself and my family by working here in my home country. So what I'll do is I'll move to the West and get a much better paid job there.
And so I guess it seems more like the kind of creme de la creme, these kind of cutting, bleeding edge technologies, are what you're saying is they can sometimes take the place of like the filling in the basics, whether that's paying doctors a decent salary or, you know, providing, you know, better to have five cheaper, simple hospitals spread across a country offering a basic level of modern healthcare rather than one center of excellence in the capital offering kind of Western style healthcare to the tiny few who can afford it.
Yes, and it's not just hospitals. It's paying the workers. A lot of it is community healthcare projects and so on. But you need to have a reasonably well-paid, highly motivated workforce in order to run health service. And if you starve the health workers of reasonable wages and resources kind of avaricious and rapacious commercial companies from the West who entrap governments into loan schemes and leading to... And the other factor, unfortunately, in so many of these countries, and of course this is a problem in the West, true, isn't, and that is corruption at high levels. In other words, if you were to buy our MRI scanner, Your Honour, we would ensure that you yourself were well rewarded for choosing our scanner.
Yeah, and so I suppose the paradoxical thing here is that actually some of these countries the common good might benefit from less money spent on MRI scanners and more spent on raising the wages of doctors so they don't feel the need to go to the West, but also, you know, filling out their healthcare system with more of the kind of cheaper essentials. But there's no real money for you. If you're a Western tech, Western healthcare company, there's no real money to be made in selling, you know, saline drips to the developing world as opposed to flogging a multi-million pound scanning machine.
And to be honest, although it's less... it's less stark. There's a similar issues within the NHS here in the UK, in that the NHS spends enormous amount of its
budget on very prestigious, expensive equipment. And often the very basic stuff, the public health screening. I mean, I, as a paediatrician, I'm quite shocked at how basic child development screening, which was one of the glories of the NHS when it first came in, was that the NHS instituted child development screening for all children across the population. And this involved screening as a newborn baby, you'd be checked over, then as at 6 weeks you'd be reviewed and carefully checked over, and then at 7 or 8 months you'd be checked over, and then at 18 months you'd be checked over, and then at 3 years you'd be checked over, and then at 5 years when you started school a doctor would check you and all that, and many conditions to do with eyesight and hearing and other asthma and all kinds of conditions would be picked up at these developmental screenings. Pretty well this has all been stripped away. Far too expensive, far too unnecessary, you know, and we'll invest in MRI scanners instead. And sadly, I think the loss is probably, you know, greater than the benefit, that's the marginal benefit that's produced by some of the most expensive equipment.
So I suppose the question therefore is, like, why is it that even in, you know, whether it's a wealthy systems or less well-resourced systems, we keep pouring money into the kind of sexy, cutting-edge breakthrough technologies, you know, the new cancer drugs that might extend the life of people on a very rare cancer for 3 months, as opposed to the kind of boring, everyday, humdrum, mass-level healthcare stuff that has been proven to improve outcomes, life expectancies, you know, pick up regular, everyday diseases. Why is that stuff getting neglected in favour of the much kind of flashier, much more expensive, less proven, cutting-edge stuff?
Yes, and it's an interesting question, and I'm sure it's complex, but a lot of it is to do with the public perceptions. Part of it is just democratic processes. What do people complain to their MPs about? Who are the people who are agitating and pressurizing democratic sources in order to get changes? Who are the people who are complaining about the health service by and large? And the answer is, it's not young parents with a child who never got any developmental screening. It tends to be the older, articulate members of the community who are have read somewhere that this new screening technique or this new cancer treatment or something for Alzheimer's disease or for heart disease is now available, and why can I not get it here in the NHS? So then there are the sort of incentives within the funders themselves. So the funding bodies, the NHS, the Medical Research Council, the Wellcome Trust, they've switched from maximizing sheer outcomes to what they call impact. In other words, tell a story which can be noticed by the public. Let's demonstrate to the public that what we're doing is really having an impact. And so,
even though some of the things that have the greatest impact are invisible, you know, think something like adding fluoride to drinking water, you know, has improved the lives of billions of human beings, but it's not fancy. It didn't require any breakthrough in the lab. You couldn't, you know, win a Pulitzer Prize by writing a big newspaper magazine article about it. It's just one of those boring, everyday things that has tiny incremental improvements to human health.
Yeah, this reminds me of an anecdote. When I was working as a medical researcher, we were doing research using new scanning devices for babies' brains. And we'd got a grant from a medical research charity. And at the end of the 3-year grant, I sent them an end of a grant report of the work that we'd done and so on. And the charity turned it into a press release. But this was sort of months later after the report had gone in. But clearly someone within the charity was sort of working through it. And they turned it into a press release. And out of the blue, I suddenly get rung up by BBC Television News saying, we've just received this press release about this breakthrough that you've been making in studying babies' brains, and we think this is wonderful, and we'd like to run an item on this in tonight's BBC News. And we'd like to send round a crew to record, but they need to come in the next 2 hours to record this breakthrough. And, you know, and I was trying to explain, well, you know, it's not exactly a sort of, no, but it sounds so really interesting. And basically, again, there's all these kind of perverse incentives to, well, it's not perverse incentives, but they're incentives to tell a particular story. The Medical Research Council wants to demonstrate that it is spending money wisely. The people in the news media are looking for a nice, positive news story to balance the bad news in the, and people in the university are wanting to tell the story. And so the net effect is that positive news items about health receive a lot of coverage, a lot of interest, and often these stories go around the world. And therefore, there is a sort of demand for the latest breakthrough, which comes with an aura of science, of health, of positivity, of overcoming all the negatives of disease.
It taps into that deep kind of human longing to break free of the kind of shackles of this earthbound prison that we call our bodies. You know, this idea that we should no longer, that kind of profoundly modern post-enlightenment, we should no longer have to accept as inevitable the things that previous generations said were unchangeable. That, yeah, we're on this upward bound, we're moving forward, we're always living longer and healthier and defeating and eradicating more diseases. The other example that really comes to mind when talking about this is something called the Cancer Drugs Fund, which was a government policy here in the UK about just over a decade ago, when so the normal body in the NHS that kind of regulates what treatments are going to be paid for by our taxpayer-funded healthcare system is called the National Institute for Clinical and Healthcare Excellence, I think, or NICE. So NICE, their job is normally to kind of make assessments of new drugs and treatments and use this kind of complicated algorithm process to figure out if the cost of buying this into the NHS and making it available to British citizens is worth it. And the fundamental premise is that not all things can be afforded. There is a limited amount of money in the pot, and therefore we will have to say no to some super expensive cutting edge drugs if we don't believe that they provide enough benefit, enough bang for the buck. And this was working away and kind of in the background. But then over time, as it became more known, there was kind of a media campaign, a few kind of well-planned kind of patient campaigns, activists basically saying, you know, it's not fair. NICE is denying us, you know, in America, if you have the right insurance, you can get this amazing drug that supposedly, you know, extends your life for 2 days or whatever, but it's super worth it and totally worth it. NICE has said, no, it's too expensive. That's not acceptable, when they started besieging their MPs and going to the newspapers. And eventually that democratic pressure bore on the government, and the government, despite ostensibly at that point enacting a kind of period of austerity and cutting back on public spending, set up a brand new fund called the Cancer Drugs Fund, which kind of bypassed the NICE system entirely and was a separate pot of money simply for buying drugs that NICE had already decided did not meet the government's kind of stated policy aims in terms of fitting within the funding envelope for the NHS. And you know, pharmaceutical companies loved that, obviously, because there was this new kind of customer to bid into. And it was massively praised as this good news story. You know, the newspapers claimed it as a triumph. Finally, British people are not going to be locked out of this amazing breakthroughs in science. But I've always had this niggling doubt that actually, is it actually a good thing? It feels cruel or harsh to say that sometimes we shouldn't do healthcare. But actually, there is sometimes even a quite Christian argument for saying enough is enough.
It seems like anxiety is everywhere today, but as Christians, we know that even in life's storms, God's peace is available to us. That's why this month, to thank you for your support of Premier Insight, we'll send you a special resource called Held in the Storm, Finding God's Peace in an Age of Anxiety. This encouraging ebook explores how believers can find peace in uncertainty, trust God in difficult seasons, and become a steady, Christ-centered presence in an anxious world. Please know that it's your support that makes this program possible and helps Premier Insight continue creating trusted Christian content that equips people with biblical wisdom and hope, which is why your gift today is just so important. So please give today at premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death. That's premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death. And make sure you request your copy of Held in the Storm, Finding God's Peace in an Age of Anxiety.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, this is not new. This has been an age-old issue in provision of healthcare. The recognition that the demand for healthcare is virtually inexhaustible. The resources we have are limited, and therefore hard decisions have to be made as to about priorities. And in fact, I mean, in the acute situation, this is called triage. And I remember we talked about this years ago, didn't we, in an early podcast.
One of our first ever episodes, I think. Yeah.
Because it was a very, very important issue in the COVID pandemic. So these podcasts started in the COVID pandemic, and issues of triage were very important, and triage starts as a French word, starts in on the battlefield as decisions that military doctors had to make, and you basically divide people into three categories: those who are so hideously wounded that there's nothing that can be done for them, those who are so trivially wounded that there's no need, they don't need anything, and then a category in between, those who are significantly wounded but you can actually make a difference. And that, so you divide everybody into these three categories, and you concentrate all your resources on the middle category. But that concept applies more widely into populations, into saying, you know, there are some conditions and that are untreatable, and therefore we shouldn't be putting large sums of resources. There are some conditions which are trivial and don't need resources, but there are those conditions where we can really make a difference. Let's concentrate on where we can make the maximum difference, and to put it slightly crudely, the maximum bang for the buck. And you know, I would regard that principle as one of stewardship. This is wise stewardship of limited resources, and from a Christian point of view, that's something which has always been seen as an important part of wisdom. And you can see it there in the Old Testament, in the wisdom literature. And Jesus used an example of wise stewards who gave to servants different amounts and who expected them to use it wisely.
I suppose it's challenging thinking of that. We think of healthcare, or at least some people think of healthcare, as a human right, you know, not a service or a good like money or clothes or something that can be divided and allocated strategically, but something that all people have a right to. We have a right to live healthily, and if we are unwell, we have a right to be made better. And I think you could even sketch out a kind of Christian understanding of that. That's about love of the neighbor. Wanting them to be made whole, for their bodies to work in the way that God designed them to work, is a good thing. And if there is a way of making someone better, we shouldn't first stop to count the pennies and figure out if it's how much it is. We should focus on, you know, this is a human being made in God's image. They are broken, and we can make them well. How could we ever say no?
Well, and of course, you know, healthcare resonates very, very closely with Christian thinking. And if you go right back to the gospel narratives, it's clear that the healing miracles of Jesus play a central role. And the early church takes on the ministry of caring for the sick. You know, the first hospitals are those run by the church, that the church Christians play a very vital role in the plague and so on. So I think the important thing to realize is that in the history of Christian healthcare, the emphasis has always been primarily on caring. And there's an old tag which I remember being taught as a young medical student, and that is to cure a few, to relieve many, to care for all. That was the slogan of Christian healthcare over the centuries. It recognized that actually the numbers that could be cured were relatively small. The focus was on caring as Jesus cared. We couldn't always do the miracles that Jesus could do, but it was the calling to be there and to care for the sickest. And so that, once the medicine changes into becoming a highly effective means of treating disease, the danger is that the priorities get altered, and we lose that Christian focus on care.
That's really interesting. So it sounds like you're saying, for the first kind of 1,950 years of Christian health, of Christians being involved in healthcare, which, as you say, is basically goes back to the very first, you know, early church, the disciples, there wasn't much of a tension between, you know, more doctoring was obviously more Christian. But then as soon as in the last kind of your lifetime, really, the post-war era, 1950s right. onwards, suddenly with the advent of modern science and technology, healthcare shifts from being we can only really cure a tiny number and most of it is about care, to being the purpose of doctoring is to make people better and send them away and never see them again. And therefore, that now you develop this strange tension where healthcare is a profoundly Christian vocation, as you've explained, and yet sometimes the most Christian thing to do is to do less healthcare, not more.
Well, to do less expensive and sophisticated healthcare, we never stop caring, but we do accept that it's always been in the Christian understanding of healthcare that there are many, many times where you say enough is enough. We've done as much as we can for this one particular patient, and we must care for others who are just as needy. And I think it is interesting, this switch. It really takes place really from the Second World War onwards. It was in the Second World War that the antibiotics are just coming in, new methods of keeping people alive on the battlefield, methods, you know, which then became methods of mechanical ventilation and intensive support, surgical treatments and so on, were all improving, anaesthesia in particular, and all of this led to a dramatic improvements. Of course, there were other advances like vaccinations and so on. So it's a complicated story. But I think that this, you're right, that healthcare changes from this emphasis on care to maximizing positive outcomes. It then becomes very utilitarian. The danger is it does. It becomes, how do we maximize health outcomes? And it also taps into this deep fear of death and mortality. Until that period, trusting in doctors when you were fearful of death was always regarded as a pretty hopeless, a pointless. Why would you trust in doctors? What use would they be? You know, but now, of course, medicine has become the new kind of salvation, a materialist version of salvation.
And I suppose the danger is that because it's not like any other good or service, as you say, people, it, the kind of demand for it, because it is deals with your own kind of life, the demand for it is not as tightly constrained to how much money you have or anything else. And so the risk is that once it becomes possible to do treatment, and every year, as we know, scientists are discovering new treatments and new forms and new machines and new drugs, how can you ever say no? Because this is a matter of life and death. And so it becomes a, is there a risk that it becomes almost a form of idolatry, where even Christians can kind of delude themselves that this is, can only ever be a good thing to pursue more and more treatment and more medicine and more healthcare, when actually it could be to the detriment of other people?
No, I think you're right. I think at its most extreme, it does become a kind of idolatry. It is bodily health, bodily survival, longevity, which is the most important thing. And I think what a Christian perspective says is that these things are important, they are valuable, they are genuine goods, but they're not the supreme good. There are some things that are even higher than surviving for a long life. And that might be giving your life for someone else. Greater love has no one than they give their life for their friends. So, and you know, an instinct of parents is to be sacrificial for their children, and the instincts of Christian communities have always been to sacrifice those who are the most, have the greatest resources, to sacrifice what they have for those who are the most needy. And certainly, I mean, if you did a thought experiment whereby, you know, you had a whole Christian local church, and the question was, you know, we need to decide who, we've only got very limited resources, who should we spend our money for the most elderly, or should we spend our money for the children who desperately need it and are in danger of dying? And I think it's pretty clear how any local church congregation would decide. The problem is how you translate that into the context of a nationalized health service when all of a sudden I demand my rights and I, you know, I want to get the very best possible care I can.
And as we've talked in previous episodes, it's often the older and the sicker people who vote the most, and their vote, their demands are often more keenly felt by politicians in Parliament. And that's why you end up with vast sums poured into cancer treatment, into dementia research, when, you know, a fraction of that money could go and provide clean drinking water for people somewhere else in the world, you know, something that we all take for granted, but is not actually available. But, you know, it's not, you can't tell a story around, you know, spending £1 billion going and providing clean drinking and sanitation for someone in sub-Saharan Africa in the way that if you say, I'm going to invest £1 billion in a speculative research that might be able to extend the lifetime of someone with Alzheimer's for 6 months, it's more compelling.
And it just seems, sadly, that these sort of global inequities are just getting bigger and bigger. There have always been inequities. And, I mean, it's one of the debates that we often get into is, even if the rich are doing better and better, we shouldn't worry about that, because there's always a trickle down. It means that the poor will also do better, because they'll
rising
get the crumbs.
Rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah, they'll get the crumbs which fall from the richest table. Whereas others who say it's the inequity itself, the fact that some people are dying of treatable diseases whilst the richest people can have the most ridiculous, unnecessary medical interventions. It's that inequity which we have to resolve. And these are deep and difficult challenges. I think I want to end on a positive note, and that is I came away from my conversations often quite encouraged by the particular initiatives that Christians had been taking and were taking to address some of these challenges and inequities, particularly in low-resource countries, where Christians have been involved in public advocacy to ensure including, if necessary, industrial action to try to ensure that wages for healthcare workers were being protected, that the working conditions were being improved, and putting pressure on governments as part of a Christian desire for healthcare, for justice in the healthcare area. And that meant, if necessary, it was Christians who were arguing against governments going for the most expensive and the most prestigious kinds of medical treatment in order to ensure that there was better provision for healthcare across the country.
Mm. Yeah, that is encouraging. And I think there is a conversation to be had here in the West around healthcare rationing and, you know, challenging our idolatrous desires to live longer and longer and have more and more and more. But there's also a conversation to be had about to what extent are we kind of pushing our own governments, you know, making it in our own government's interest to act in the common good and to, you know, I'm thinking here in the UK, the government has repeatedly cut back its international aid budget in recent times and says, you know, we can't afford to give that much money overseas. We need to reinvest it. And, you know, these are not easy decisions. You know, there's what they're spending on is often important things, you know, rearmament for a possible war with Russia or pensions or something like that. But what I would love is if Christians and others, people of, you know, good faith, made it clear that their democratic desires, that they would elect people who saw their leadership in the round, and their job is not just to feather nests of already wealthy people in the West, but also to use the resources of these rich Western countries in a way which benefits everyone around the world and contributes to the common good. And that is fundamentally only going to come from the bottom up. Politicians will respond to the pressure they experience from the voters if the voters make clear that this is a priority for them.
Yes, and sadly that fact that the UK used to be seen as one of the most generous international donors in and using its budget actually very well and in general very thoughtfully, and sadly the fact that there's been such a massive cutback in British aid, and at the same time there's, as we've talked about previously, there's been a massive cutback in the USA in the amount of foreign aid going for medical. This has really had an impact across the world and is having all kinds of untold consequences.
Mm. And there's this, I just don't think any Christians can sleep comfortably at night knowing that, as you say, you know, USAID was gutted and that is, you know, credibly being linked. You know, every £100 million that you cut from there leads to X number of hundreds of thousands of preventable deaths from malaria. Because, you know, in many parts of the world, it is US aid money which underpins the kind of vaccination and treatment programs for these diseases. And yet, at the same time, America spends more and more and more pursuing ever more esoteric efforts to extend life of people who already live very long lives. I don't know. It just, there's something deep, profoundly uncomfortable with the way that the money seems to always be there to pay to go into the big pharma companies and the cutting edge Silicon Valley tech healthcare firms who are exploring these obscure ways of squeezing out an extra year or two, and yet somehow the richest countries on earth cannot afford money to do incredibly basic life saving treatments and preventions in the rest of the world.
Yes, I agree with that, but again, I don't want to end on a sort of a sour note, because it is extraordinary to see practically what Christians in the healthcare world are doing. It's fascinating that so often, and again, this goes back right to the very beginning, if you look at, for instance, work among leprosy victims, it's almost entirely done by Christians across the world. If you look among work among the most deprived, amongst the untouchables, amongst it was true about AIDS victims in the early days of the AIDS epidemic and so on, time and again Christians are drawn, understandably, to be there with the most vulnerable because they recognize that this is their Christian calling, and it really makes a difference. And And other people notice. You know, it's well known that in many countries, the government officials would choose to go to a Christian hospital if they themselves become unwell, because they get a better standard of care. They get dedicated people who believe in their in what they're doing, in the service they're doing, and they notice. It makes a difference.
Definitely. All right, well, let's draw it to a close there. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'd love to know what your own thoughts are, particularly if you work in medicine in some capacity, but even if not, you know, how do you think about this question of resource distribution, the idolatry of ever cutting-edge, bleeding-edge technology and research in medicine, and how we can more equitably share the benefits of our medical revolution around the world, or other ideas for things we haven't talked about on the podcast before. We always like to hear your disagreements, your challenges, your questions, your suggestions. You can email us molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. And as always, there's lots more to read and listen to and watch on Dad's website. You can find that at johnwyatt.com. And you can find all of my journalism at my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, I recommend you sign up for my weekly church news newsletter called The Critical Friend, which you can do so for free at tswyatt.com. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.